Okay. I'm glad you gave me time here. I'm having a little difficulty. We did get some early electrical motor parts and things of this sort, spool bodies, sort of wrapping coils and things of this sort. We had a reasonable size hip for a while in a cast film for photographic aerial photography. This despite the fact that the color wasn't as good. This was when the spy in the sky activity was going on, and they were interested in photographic film, which you could take a series of pictures and run them through developing and then cut them out and splice them. And one of the problems with most film is that it absorbs moisture and expands and contracts and shrinks a little bit and does this and that during processing, and there's no certainty that everything will match the scale, etc. But it was discovered that polycarbonate film was essentially free of all these liabilities. So Ansco Chemical Company, or Ansco Film, was actually a pretty sizable customer for polycarbonate, which they dissolved as a solvent and cast into aerial film. That was an application. I'm not sure where we made a big breakthrough, though, in getting some big applications. Another one that was kind of early, again, based on the toughness, was we had some odometer hubs for rental vehicles. And what these were just little mileage indicators on the hub that had a transparent cover so you could check how many miles the thing had gone. And this, for a while, was a pretty interesting application for us because it had to stand up under stones and had to be maintained transparency and weatherability and things. We capitalized on one of the things about this one is that we made a little thing that looked like a small pie plate, which was the odometer hub and cover, and we ran contests in places like Detroit and offered a genuine $25 defense bond if anybody can break it. And we gave out hundreds of these things, maybe thousands of them. And every time somebody would come back with a broken one, we would get a lot of free publicity in the papers talking about how so-and-so won a defense bond by breaking this unbreakable plastic. And this worked pretty well. We got a lot of free advertising out of it, and some of the people had some very interesting ways of breaking it, but as a result of this low-cost advertising, we end up with a lot of people who found some useful applications for the product. And we started growing. We got some early hits here and there in automotive, such as people looked quite early at taillights, which we couldn't beat the acrylic on cost. And we did get into aftermarkets and into commercial vehicles and things of this sort. We got into taillights because in a taillight, if you break a taillight on a car, the insurance company fixes it. If you break a taillight on a commercial vehicle, you fix it. And a taillight that costs $2 out of acrylic might cost $4 out of polycarbonate, but the replacement cost is $20 or something. So it's quite easy to sell in this kind of market. We did get special applications for non-breakable taillights and lighting covers and things of the sort. One of the other ones that was kind of early when we got reasonably good product was street lights. And I like to tell the story that Central Park had street lights that had an average life of probably a couple of days, half-life, and they put in some polycarbonate light covers, and they lasted for years.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't break, but they had bullet holes in them, and they turned so raunchy brown that they wouldn't let light through, but they were still intact. But that was one of the early applications for the polycarbonate, a light cover.
Mm-hmm.
McDonald's Golden Arches.
Hmm?
McDonald's.
Right
Golden
now,
Arches.
We have a lot of outdoor standees and things like that.
Was it pretty much on schedule as far as the, did it become profitable as quickly as hoped, or was it lagging behind?
It made out pretty well. We built a 5 million pound plant, and there were a lot of people questioning what the hell we're going to do with 5 million pounds of this stuff. But by the time we were up and running, we reasonably well had the 5 million pound plant sold or committed, and we started thinking about expansion. And I guess we have been in a...
This was in Mount Vernon.
In Mount Vernon, essentially an expansion mode ever since.
That was, what, 1960 when that came on?
1960 it came on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the middle of a cornfield, and we had leased the adjoining fields to farmers for growing corn, and there was corn all around the place, and we owned acres and acres, and the question is, what are we going to do with all this land?
Mm-hmm.
Well, subsequently, we have found that that land has appreciated very greatly beyond our cornfields, and we are buying back acres at prices that we probably paid for the whole site in the first place as we try to expand the plant.
Yeah, not knowing too much about chemistry, what, using a phosgene in large quantities in a plant like this, was this something new and difficult for the, is the problem?
Yes. It did then and still does pose a hazard. The thing that we had going for us, though, was that phosgene was in large use by a number of other companies before we got involved. I don't know whether it's in place here, but in case you're not aware, the Mobay, which is our other manufacturer in the States before Dow entered, was really a joint venture of Monsanto and Bayer Chemical Company in Germany. And Bayer happened to be the world's leading manufacturer of polyurethane resins. And polyurethanes are based on phosgene. And Bayer wanted to enter the U.S. market, and as a German company at the time would have had significant problems. So they formed a joint venture with Monsanto Chemical to manufacture and sell polyurethane in this country. And so they have had phosgene capability here in this country to make polyurethane. And at a somewhat later date, our government decided that they should break up, force them to separate, and Mobay became then a wholly owned subsidiary of Bayer, and Monsanto was out of it. But from the very beginning, Mobay did have phosgene capability and experience, and et cetera. So they were knowledgeable. But we acquired, not from Mobay, but from anybody that had constructed phosgene handling facilities, the knowledge that they could gain from the industrial use. So it was not a total frightening undertaking. We had good advice. But I would say that we have been tightening up our whole phosgene handling thing ever since, and investing an awful lot of money and trying to make the stuff doubly safe and then triply safe and quadruply safe. And we have do all of our handling, for example, in a room, within a room, with all kind of exhaust systems which will neutralize this material, and they are actually operating under positive pressure to keep the stuff from migrating out. It has to stay in. There are all kinds of safeguards, but this has been gradually tightened as our, in our case, the EPA, OSHA people here, and in Europe, the European codes are even tighter.
Has there ever been a serious problem?
We have had one or two small discharges, and to my knowledge, I don't think the DE is advertised. I think we probably had a casualty from Potsdam.
There wasn't any. This didn't tend to block or cause anyone to have second thoughts about going into the business, the fact that you'd have to develop this capability, which was so different than anything, I suppose.
I don't really think it did. And you can always call it carbonyl chloride.
That's like magnetic resonance.
Yeah.
Yes.
What might be more important here is the question of phenol itself. GE suddenly becomes a leading manufacturer of phenol, putting up a world-scale 400 million plus pounds per year plant in Mount Vernon. The phenol, of course, is critical to the quality of the polycarbonate and also to independence from supply. That must have been a significant decision to move
into. It's an interesting story. I know whether it's historically of interest, but we did have a phenol plant here in Pittsfield during the Second World War. And we were using...
Coal tar plant.
No. A chlorobenzene...
The old Dow...
Hydraulic Dow propane.
Yeah.
We operated it successfully. We built it in order to provide ourselves with phenol, which was required to make our phenol formaldehyde resin. And during the war, there was a severe shortage of phenol, and it was very difficult to get phenol. So we actually made our own to supply our own uses. I think that our plant was less than the most efficient. And I have been told that our cost of production of phenol was equivalent to or slightly higher than the market price of phenol. So there was no economic incentive to operate it. But we did operate it because there was no commercial phenol. So as soon as the war was over, we stopped running our phenol plant. The skeleton still remains out back here. All our only need for phenol at the time was for phenolic resin. And when we started the polycarbonate, we had a 5 million pound plant.
Mm-hmm.
And we only needed most 5 million pounds of phenol for that, and I don't know how much, maybe 20, 30, 40 million pounds for the phenolic resin business. And this is considerably less than an economical sized plant. And the economical size plant at the time, I think, was maybe 50 million pounds as a minimum size plant. And we needed about 25 or 30 million. So we started looking at ways to get into the phenol plant, our business. And as soon as we could grow our market a little bit more, our use a little bit more, we would get into the business. And we got our applications up to maybe 40 million. Thereabouts, only 10 million short, maybe even 45 million, and we start letting it be known we're going to win the phenol business, and the price of phenol drops a penny or two pennies, and it's no longer an economical thing to do, and we took the penny or two pennies and sat there, and our volume did a little bit more. We were at the economical size, but now the economical size for a phenol plant is 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
So we only have half a plant if we go. And the people who are selling us phenol, or operating out of 100 million pound plants. So we let the go out, and PPO came along. We needed some more phenol for that, so we built up a little market, and we get close to 100 million. Now the economical size is up to 200 million, but we let the industry know that we were coming in the business, and they cut the price, temporarily at least, for us, which removed the incentive to make our own economic incentive. So we've played that game for a long time, and finally, I don't know what the exact date is, but we bit the bullet and decided we're going to have a world-class economical plant, and at that time it turned out to be, I don't know, in excess of 400 million pounds, maybe closer to 500 million pound capacity, which was a lot more than we needed at the time. But we built the plant and have been operating it, and finally we had control of our major raw material, and we not only the economics of it, but we also had control of the quality. The same thing happened in bisphenol A. In bisphenol A, there were a few merchant producers, but nobody produced polymer grade BPA. In order to get polymer grade BPA, we had to pay premiums, and we had to do some purification of our own and all sorts of stuff, and at best it was marginal.
Yeah.
And we literally hunted around the world for the best quality BPA we could get and bought from everywhere, but this was no way to run a business.
Yeah.
And eventually we decided we had to make our own, so we went into the bisphenol A business, and again we were then sizable, but we've outgrown the original plant on a number of times, and are in the process right now of bringing on still a larger capacity with more sophisticated processing. Just a little sidelight on bisphenol A. Bisphenol A's major application was in epoxy resins. And when you make bisphenol A, you make about roughly 80 or 90% polycarbonate grade material, and you make 10 or 20% isomeric mixtures and stuff, which really aren't any good at all to make polycarbonates. But the whole gamish is perfectly fine for making epoxy resins.
Mm-hmm.
So what we were asking for was somebody to take the bisphenol A, cut out the heart and give it to us, and go with the rest of it to the epoxy resin. And they would do that for a premium, but really their business was supplying the epoxy resin business. Now, this is one of the cases, incidentally, where Dow right now will have a little advantage, and that is that they make epoxies or sell to the epoxy business,
yeah,
and they have gotten into the polycarbonate business, so now they can throw away the or skim off the quality material and use that for polycarbonates, and the rest of it going into epoxy. So to get around this thing, the only way you could handle it practically was to stop making this 10 to 20% isomers and things of this sort. So we have spent an awful lot of time and effort,
mm-hmm,
in tightening up the process so we don't make as much of,
yeah,
the undesirable byproducts. And this has been the subject of a lot of research, and in this we have worked with a research laboratory.
Yeah.
We have a total new process coming on stream.
You also tried to go into the epoxy business a little while ago.
Well,
too.
We tried to get into the epoxy
that
business.
That didn't work out.
It had some bad press.
Yeah.
And we got scared away from it. But we have been in and out of the epoxy business quite a few times. We are a pretty large consumer of epoxy resins in our laminated product business.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually formulate epoxies. And they, incidentally, can use the poor purity material to some extent, but the amount they need is small compared to the amount we would generate. But epoxies are a good business, but GE has elected to not get involved.
Let's go back to your own career for a minute. You mentioned that you went on to be the advanced development manager for the
CDO
just at the time when Lexan was on its feet and PPO was coming along from the research lab.
Just the time that Lexan was going commercial, what happened when they went commercial, they took all the people with them, and they stripped us of all of our equipment. And I was a captain of a ship without one, as far as chemistry is concerned. And I had an engineering partner who was a captain of an engineering corporation without a, any engineering facilities, very few people. And my job was to go find some new business opportunities. And prior to leaving Schenectady, I had developed an interest in aromatic, polyaromatic ethers. And I'd actually tried to make some aromatic polyethers and had made some, but I was using the perchlorophenol route in self-condensation.
This goes back to Guayaquil days, your interest in...
No, it's just the fact that I was interested in something that wouldn't hydrolyze. I still had a hydrolysis thing, and polyethers wouldn't hydrolyze, and there wasn't a polyether polymer in the market. And I got attached to that and started experimenting, and I laboriously made dimers, trimers, tetramers by one-step reactions, and then I coupled them together, and I made quite high molecular weight 1,4 polyphenylene oxide. And I discovered that it was a crystalline product, and at this time I knew about TGs, had a pretty low TG, and not particularly high TM. In many respects, it's very comparable to PET, but a little bit higher temperature on the TG.
And you had done all of this before the oxidative polymerization reaction and was first run.
Right. I'd been running on this, experimenting, and what I needed to make my polymers was an autoclave. I was going to put my perchlorophenoxide salt in an autoclave and heat it up and run it, self-condense it. I needed an autoclave, and there was, I didn't have any in Schenectady at the works, but I knew there was some out of the research laboratory, and I called my acquaintance, Art Beakey, and asked him, could he get me into the autoclaves out there to run the experiment, talk with him about it. Yeah, he'd get me in. So I ran a couple, and they were complete fiasco. All I did was produce tar, or not tar, but char. That reaction doesn't go there. It isn't controllable under the condition I was running. But I was intrigued with that. And then, actually, in 1956, when Al Hay invented PPO, and I learned about it, and I immediately got intrigued with that, and that's the product I wanted. All I need to do is have him straighten it out so he left the methyl groups off, and we would make the product I wanted, polyphenylene oxide. And I started supporting that here. And let's see, some of the interesting vignettes. I end up with, I had two chemists to work. I wanted to get more, and we had a little tight situation here, and I couldn't have any more people. And there was a project, I knew that our direct energy conversion operation had a project making fuel cells for space applications. And what they needed was an ion exchange resin for their fuel cell, and I figured that the PPO would make a very good ion exchange resin, as it could be chlorinated and quaternized or sulfonated or what you have. So I touched base with the man who was running that project and told him I could give you some good chemistry if you could give me some financial support. And he agreed to underwrite a couple of chemists. So I went looking for some chemists to use up his money and work on his project to make ion exchange resin out of PPO. And the guys I got, one was Pop Shanahan, another one was Tim Borman, and I end up a little bit later, well, that's a slightly different story, but I got this project going, and we were trying to make PPO, and we did make PPO here.
This was the very first application of PPO with this field cell vessel.
That's what I was going for.
Yeah.
And that's the guise under which I was able to get a little funding to expand the program. But we were trying to make a molding compound out of it. And Ed made a polymer, a fair amount of polymer. And the polymer that we were making every time we tried to mold it would gel. And we had a rig called a capillary plastometer here where we forced polymer back and forth through an orifice under pressure. And it was supposed to, when we could follow the time it took to go back and forth and less the viscosity, and PPO would start like this. And the viscosity just kept going out of sight and it would set up gel, wouldn't process.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of work in trying to clean it up and purify it. And the purification, the purer we got it, the better it became. And one of the things that was quite obvious, that all the material we had contained a lot of residual copper salts, and copper salts are the best oxidation promoter catalyst that you can get. And also it had a lot of amine in it that we couldn't get out. And we dissolved it and dissolved, re-precipitated, and extracted. And the cleaner we got it, the more resistant it got to this premature gelation, turning to charcoal. And had a real program going on at trying to purify it. And we were working with the research laboratory on this. I would say that, I'll send you some couple of early letters here, but one of the things was we had very little support from our management at the time on this, because we already had a thermoplastic which was difficult to process and we didn't know what to do with it, and you're trying to give us another one, and no way. So a lot of this, that's one of the reasons I had to go outside for funding. Another place, Edie Boldebuck had checked the stuff and found out that you could put it in a sealed tube and heat it at 150 effect. Again, I'm back to my hydrolysis. So I found that the Army Medical Corps was advertising for people to work on plastics which could be made into medical surgical equipment which could be autoclaved. And again, that autoclave, so I went down to see the people at Port Totten, I think it was, out in New York, and spent a day selling and ended up getting a contract to develop PPO as a polymer to make medical equipment for surgical applications.
Let's pause for a moment.